I'm Jean Marie Laskus. I'm a journalist. I spent my career helping Americans understand the lives of other Americans. Coal miners, gun shop clerks, staffers in the White House mailroom. In my new podcast, Cement City, I tell the story of an entire town. A dying town that you have absolutely no reason to care about. But trust me, you will. Listen to and follow Cement City, an Odyssey original podcast in partnership with Cement City Productions. Available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
8:14 now on this Tuesday morning. Highs today of 92 with a 40% chance for showers. Then it turns rainy for the next 3 days, which is good because it can keep the highs in the mid-80s. 60% chance for showers. Certainly we don't want any street flooding, but beyond that, Saturday and Sunday, they're talking a little bit of a front, lower humidity, highs in the mid-80s, which is going to certainly be a little hint of fall, at least, and we'll gladly take that. Bruce Jennelson joins us, professor of public policy, political science at Duke University. Our friend previously worked in the State Department and on the Middle East peace process, so he's been there, literally done that, and he knows the players involved and the context of a lot of these things that are going on. How you doing, Bruce?
I'm doing well, Tommy. Hope you are as well.
I am, sir. Bad news over the weekend with Hamas. And for people that don't know and missed it, explain what happened, please, with the six hostages.
Yeah, there were six hostages who were murdered by Hamas. One of whom is an American Israeli whose parents spoke at the Democratic National Convention a couple weeks ago. And this set of hostages kind of, you know, there have been sadly many other hostages killed and died. It sort of seems to have really focused and pushed the politics and the strategy in the United States and somewhat in Israel to a point where there's much more pressure now to try to get a ceasefire and a deal to release the remaining hostages.
My initial, and not being a diplomat or involved as you were in this, my initial reaction is, you know, this is not going to do the people of Gaza any good at all, because if you're going to, as the Israelis were closing in, as I understand it, that's when they decided to shoot the hostages in the back of the head. Am I accurate there or not?
There appear to be reports that a rescue operation was underway, but it's not clear that it actually was. And at this point, you know, it's hard to know whether it was or it wasn't, but it did precipitate the killing in cold blood of these six hostages.
That is not in dispute, right? That they did execute the six hostages, shooting them in the back of the head.
Correct. Correct.
So when Hamas does that, that doesn't do anything to further the peace process at all, or any type of ceasefire or cessation of hostilities.
Well, it's interesting. In Israel, in some ways it did. Because the sense in Israel was not only, you know, that Hamas is terrible, evil, but that their government, their prime minister, could have had a ceasefire that many in Israel believe is an option still in Israel's security interests, that would have released these hostages and prevented them from being killed. And the same reaction in the United States. President Biden was pretty frank when he was asked yesterday by the media, is Prime Minister Netanyahu doing enough to get a ceasefire and release the hostages? He said no. It doesn't mean Hamas is doing a lot, but this is really an effort, and there's a sense in Israel now that Netanyahu continues to put his own political interests, his coalition, and the stability of his government so he doesn't face prosecution far above the interests of his own people. It's not giving in to Hamas now to try to rescue hostages. Many Israelis see this as in Israel's interest.
I get everything that you're saying, but the people of Israel have to be looking at the end game here, Bruce. They can't in any way, give any reason to Hamas for executing these hostages or in any way. I don't see how that gets traced back to Netanyahu. I understand that he could have had this peace arrangement, but that doesn't in any way excuse their actions.
Well, what's happened in Israel, you know, if you ask the polling question of, you know, what do you think of Hamas, you know, 80-90%, you know, see them as evil, as a threat. But what's also happening in Israel is saying, you know, we need to deal with this threat, but we can deal with this threat and rescue our people, bring them home, and also, you know, have a ceasefire that can give us, you know, in some ways, a better chance of security than the current war does. You know, Netanyahu's notion of total victory in eliminating Hamas, you know, again, many military people and intelligence people, the former head of the Shin Bet, who I happen to know, has said, it's not going to happen. And all you're going to do is have more hostages killed. So let's move towards a credible ceasefire and deal with the Hamas threat that way. It's not a perfect option, but it's better than continuing the war.
So the Israelis are concerned with the hostages and getting them home safely and then dealing with the rest later. Is that active?
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
This is Jean Marie Laskus with the podcast Cement City. So there's this election coming up, a big one, and one guy's been indicted. People are talking voter fraud. Democracy itself is on the line. Sound familiar? Well, this isn't that election. This one is in Denora, Pennsylvania, a dying town in the middle of nowhere, where I bought a house and stayed for 3 years. Listen to and follow Cement City, an Odyssey original podcast in partnership with Cement City Productions, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Are accurate, rather?
Well, they want to deal with it all as one package. They want a ceasefire that the United States, that key Arab countries like Egypt and Qatar, and Qatar has been the main financial backer of Hamas for many years. By the way, in ways that Netanyahu, while he was prime minister for many years, kind of looked the other way because he kind of wanted Hamas to be strong enough that it would give him an excuse not to pursue peace with other more moderate Palestinians. And so there will be a ceasefire. Again, it's not perfect. But Israelis have gotten to the point after almost a year of war of saying this is making us less, not more secure. And that's coming not just from the sort of doves you might think of. It's coming from former heads of the Israeli military, former heads of the Mossad and the Shin Bet, who say we're thinking about security. Netanyahu is thinking about his own politics.
What did this do for Netanyahu's political standing in Israel, the execution of the hostages?
You know, he has a coalition government, and it keeps the people that are even to the right of him supporting him. And at the same time, you know, those people are actually provoking more violence in the West Bank by creating more outposts, you know, doing their own violence against Palestinian farmers and settlers. But public opinion now, you know, as one newspaper editorialized this morning in Israel, that Netanyahu calls himself Mr. Security. He will be known, you know, in Israel as Mr. Blood on Your Hands. So that sentiment's getting stronger and stronger.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back talking to Bruce Jennelson, professor of public policy, political science at Duke. Previously worked in the State Department on the Middle East peace process. We'll talk about the bigger picture with Hezbollah and Lebanon and more when we come back. It is 8:21. Time for traffic now, WWL. 8:26, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Bruce Jennelson, professor of public policy, political science at Duke University, previously worked on the Middle East peace process in the State Department. So he knows the individuals involved, the players here. He knows the context, the backstory. Bruce, I don't mean to belabor the point, but I guess when I heard about this and then I saw, you know, that they were trying to have polio vaccinations in Gaza, I just thought that immediately Netanyahu was going to go crazy and just bomb the place into obliteration. But you're telling me that's not going to happen, you don't think?
Well, I think he'd still like to do that very much.
Okay.
The international pressure is increasing. Britain just announced yesterday, today, that they're going to limit their arms, their shipping to Israel, to still give them the kinds of arms they need to defend themselves against Iran and Hezbollah, but not the kind of weaponry they're using in Gaza that are taking the toll on the Gaza civilians. The United States has done that a little bit, you know, up and down last few months. We may go to that point now. I think the United States has basically said, you know, we've got to get a deal this week. And if not, you know, the fingers may not be pointed just at Israel. They'll be pointed at Hamas as well. But I think they'll be more pointed at Israel at this point because there's a genuine sense that this is not in the interest of the Israeli people, and it's not in the American interest.
So what's it like in Israel every day with Hezbollah and Lebanon, and who's launching what in Israel from where?
You know, Tommy, I have some very dear Israeli friends and colleagues. One family I've been friends with for almost 50 years. We met way back in the late 70s when he came to the U.S. and we were in the same graduate school program. And we're constantly Zooming with him and his family and his wife. And, you know, I characterize him as a retired high-level national security official who's been more pro-peace than not. And what the toll it takes on daily life, I mean, you're absolutely right to raise that. You know, the civilians in Gaza are paying a huge price, but Israelis are living with insecurity. I mean, he, for example, has to modernize his home now for over $100,000 to build a safe room, right? And again, I'm not comparing that to people with polio in Gaza, but it is a sense, you're asking what it's like for Israelis, and they're more frightened than they've ever been in their history. They're more insecure. They're less confident that their own military can provide for their security. And that's something that's really profound and different than any other war they've fought.
Less confident in the military because of being overstretched?
Being overstretched. And the Israeli military, you know, over the years has won wars when it's been their military against another military. Our tanks and planes and everything can beat yours. This is using your military might, you know, to try for really a political objective to reduce terrorism. And as we found out in Iraq and Afghanistan, where we had the superior military, it doesn't guarantee you'll achieve your objectives that way. And it's a different kind of conflict, as well as being deeply stretched at war for over a year, calling up reservists, not just in their 40s, but almost in their 50s now. And then the effects of that on the economy. It's a lot of pressures on them that are why they believe that even if a ceasefire is imperfect, as long as it's good as possible and gets the hostages home, that serves them as well as the Palestinian people better than continuing the war.
How vulnerable is Israel to another October 7th attack?
It is very vulnerable. You know, and in fact, you know, there are a lot of analysis of October 7th that have shown that it was preventable. But it wasn't prevented because some of the intelligence warnings that were coming in to intelligence officials were being diverted because the government and the right wing was saying, you got to focus on the West Bank and help us, you know, build more settlements in the West Bank. And this wasn't, you know, a super plan that was, you know, something you'll write novels or spy movies about. There was information available in the moment. We're not Monday morning quarterbacking here, and it wasn't prevented. So they both have to deal with the Hamas threat and get their own military and intelligence up to the caliber that it's been in the past.
Thank you, Bruce. Appreciate your time and your insight as always. Bruce Jenelson, professor of public policy, rather political science at Duke. Just to put it in context, you know, we worry about hurricane season here, and now we approach the shank of this season, and we hope that everything's quiet. And just imagine somebody launching rockets into the state every day or the city every day, and then the anti-aircraft fire having to take those down and having to build a bomb shelter, and it just boggles my mind. We'll take a break, come back, talk about ransomware. Right now, time for WWL First News. Quarter till 9, reading from a Forbes, or Tommy Tucker, WWL, reading from a Forbes article here about ransomware. Whilst there are rumors that they might be linked, Raj Samani, chief scientist at Rapid7, says we have to acknowledge the fact that ALPHV ransomware is written in the Rust language, whereas RansomHub is written in Golang. However, Samani added, the rise of RansomHub also coincided with law enforcement making decryption keys available to keep LockBit at bay. I hope you understood what that means, because I didn't get a word of it. Alex Hammerstone joins us now, our friend, Director of Advisory Solutions for TrustedSec. How you doing, Alex?
Not bad, not bad. It's been a great weekend. How you doing?
I'm good. I didn't say anything dirty just now on the air, did I? I'm occasionally concerned that when I'm reading something I don't know, I'm going to inadvertently use a dirty phrase or something. That was all clear?
I think you're good. I think that's pretty clean. So
before we get to the high-tech stuff, let me get to the low-tech stuff. I get a text yesterday afternoon that says, and I've not seen this approach used before, it says, Ms. Doria, your jewelry, spelled with two L's, has been designed. When do you have time to come and pick it up? And I texted back and said, I've been waiting for a long time. I'll be there tomorrow at 3:30 or maybe 3:35 or possibly 3:40 if the traffic's bad, or maybe 3:20 if there's no traffic. And they texted back and said, I'm sorry, I have the wrong person. So apparently I flipped the script on them, Alex.
It's possible. It's possible that may have been a real accidental text and someone's looking for their jewelry. I think, you know, with those, the intention is to really get a conversation going and kind of get some confidence from you and have you ask, hey, this wasn't me. And then, you know, you start talking about different things, and next thing you know, they're trying to scam you in some other way.
Probably shouldn't have done it, but I just couldn't resist, and I thought it was interesting to get the text back from them. No, I'm not fooling with this. I got the wrong person. Never mind.
I'm surprised they replied after that, to be honest with you.
Let's talk about the ransomware and what's going on with the latest, I guess, because it seems as though, in what I read, it seems as though that they've now put together an all-star team with Ransom Hub ransomware. Mm-hmm. What is that?
I think the story here is that, you know, as we get better at preventing these things, or as law enforcement kind of moves in, people don't suddenly kind of move on and you know, kind of go work for some corporation, mm-hmm. right? The people that are doing these ransomware attacks are going to continue to do them. They're incredibly well organized and professional, and a lot of these different groups work together. And if you think about it, it's, you know, similar to the way that a lot of people might move around organizations for different or better opportunities, you know, to make more money or what have you. A lot of people kind of in the ransomware realm are going to be doing the same thing. And, you know, over the years, we've just seen kind of constant notifications from, you know, the government and law enforcement about how different groups are working together and, you know, how they're changing and joining other groups and so on and so forth.
So what's the latest iteration of this, and how much of a threat is it?
So I think if we look at just what's in the news, right, I mean, it's pretty obvious, I think, to all of us that the ransomware attacks, the cyber attacks are continuing to grow, right? They're not slowing down. And the bigger thing is, when you think about it, you know, most of these ransomware attacks are never going to be big news stories. They become large news stories when it's a municipality or an airport.
October 7th attack.
It is very vulnerable, you know, and in fact, you know, there are a lot of analysis of October 7th that have shown that it was preventable, but it wasn't prevented because some of the intelligence warnings that were coming in to intelligence officials were being diverted because the government and the right wing was saying, you got to focus on the West Bank and help us, you know, build more settlements in the West Bank. And this wasn't, you know, a super plan that was, you know, something you'll write novels or spy movies about. There was information available in the moment. We're not Monday morning quarterbacking here, and it wasn't prevented. So they both have to deal with the Hamas threat and get their own military and intelligence up to the caliber that it's been in the past.
Thank you, Bruce. Appreciate your time and your insight as always. Bruce Jennelson, professor of public policy, rather political science at Duke. Just to put it in context, you know, we worry about hurricane season here, and now we approach the shank of the season, and we hope that everything's quiet. And just imagine somebody launching rockets into the state every day, or the city every day, and then the anti-aircraft fire having to take those down and having to build a bomb shelter, and it just boggles my mind. We'll take a break, come back, talk about ransomware. Right now, time for WWL First News. Quarter till 9, reading from a Forbes, or Tommy Tucker, WWL, reading from a Forbes article here about ransomware. Whilst there are rumors that they might be linked, Raj Samani, chief scientist at Rapid7, says we have to acknowledge the fact that ALPHV ransomware is written in the Rust language, whereas Ransom Hub is written in Golang. However, Samani added, the rise of Ransom Hub also coincided with law enforcement making decryption keys available to keep LockBit at bay. I hope you understood what that means, because I didn't get a word of it. Alex Hammerstone joins us now, our friend, Director of Advisory Solutions for TrustedSec. How you doing, Alex?
Not bad, not bad. It's been a great weekend. How you doing?
I'm good. I didn't say anything dirty just now on the air, did I? I'm occasionally concerned that when I'm reading something I don't know, I'm going to inadvertently use a dirty phrase or something. That was all clear?
I think you're good. I think that was pretty clean. So
before we get to the high-tech stuff, let me get to the low-tech stuff. I get a text yesterday afternoon that says, and I've not seen this approach used before, it says, Ms. Doria, your jewelry, spelled with two L's, has been designed. When do you have time to come and pick it up? And I texted back and said, I've been waiting for a long time. I'll be there tomorrow at 3:30 or maybe 3:35 or possibly 3:40 if the traffic's bad, or maybe 3:20 if there's no traffic. And they texted back and said, I'm sorry, I have the wrong person. So apparently I flipped the script on them, Alex.
It's possible. It's possible that may have been a real accidental text and someone's looking for their jewelry. Well, but I think, you know, with those, the intention is to really get a conversation going and kind of get some confidence from you and have you ask, you know, hey, this wasn't me. And then, you know, you start talking about different things, and next thing you know, they're trying to scam you in some other way.
Probably shouldn't have done it, but I just couldn't resist, and I thought it was interesting to get the text back from them. No, I'm not fooling with this. I got the wrong person. Never mind.
I'm surprised they replied after that, to be honest with you.
Let's talk about the ransomware and what's going on with the latest, I guess, because it seems as though, in what I read, it seems as though that they've now put together an all-star team with Ransom Hub ransomware. Mm-hmm. What is that?
I think the story here is that, you know, as we get better at preventing these things, or as law enforcement kind of moves in, people don't suddenly kind of move on and you know, kind of go work for some corporation, mm-hmm. right? The people that are doing these ransomware attacks are going to continue to do them. They're incredibly well organized and professional, and a lot of these different groups work together. And if you think about it, it's, you know, similar to the way that a lot of people might move around organizations for different or better opportunities, you know, to make more money or what have you. A lot of people kind of in the ransomware realm are going to be doing the same thing. And, you know, over the years, we've just seen kind of constant notifications from, you know, the government and law enforcement about how different groups are working together and, you know, how they're changing and joining other groups and so on and so forth.
So what's the latest iteration of this, and how much of a threat is it?
So I think if we look at just what's in the news, right, I mean, it's pretty obvious, I think, to all of us that the ransomware attacks, the cyber attacks are continuing to grow, right? They're not slowing down. And the bigger thing is, when you think about it, you know, most of these ransomware attacks are never going to be big news stories. They become large news stories when it's a municipality or an airport or something unique, right? Something that affects a lot of consumers. But day in and day out, most of these ransomware attacks are barely going to be a blip on kind of local news channels, right? Organizations lose hundreds of thousands of dollars or even millions of dollars all the time, right? And so often that it's just not a news story. And it's just continued to grow. It's not slowing down. And I think one of the pieces, you know, from this alert that came out is that it really is all organizations that are being hit by this. You know, there's really, it's kind of gloves off. You know, they're kind of going after everybody.
What is it that we can do to protect ourselves, and or is it us that have to worry, or is it businesses primarily when it comes to ransomware attacks?
So in these cases, I mean, there are certainly ransomware attacks that affect end users, right? So you might open up your computer one day and it's, you know, your personal computer, and it's, you know, encrypted and you can't get in. But generally, if you think about the reward and kind of the risk that the ransomware operators take, they're looking for these large payouts. You know, and there might be some people out there with a very high net worth that are listening, that maybe would be willing to pay to get their files back on their personal computer. But generally, these groups are going after organizations that either have cyber insurance or have, you know, the funds to be able to pay a ransom. You know, generally, it's, if you think about it, you know, if you've got a bunch of kids and such and have, you know, a few hundred bucks in your checking account, you're probably not a target. They really are going after organizations.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. I also want to talk about something I heard on a program that we run this morning with Gordon Deal. First News, I think, is America's First News, about a lady that was scammed. They even came to her house, took her to a Bitcoin ATM, and then there was some kind of ruse where they made it seem as though $4,000 had been actually accidentally deposited into her account, which she paid back, but there was no false deposit, which means she was out of the $4,000. We'll talk about some things like that when we return as well. Alex Hammerstone, our friend, Director of Advisory Solutions for Trusted Sec. If you have any questions about internet security, tech scams, etc., he is our guy, 504-260-1870. This text comes in and says, computer tech stuff really makes me feel dumb, and I'm the smartest person I know. Well, join the club. It's constantly changing and evolving. That's why we're lucky to have Alex to talk to. 851 Traffic, WWL. 8:56, 4 till 9. Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Alex Hammerstone, our friend, Director of Advisory Solutions for Trusted Sec. So I heard on the show we run at 5 o'clock, Gordon Deal, America's First News, that a lady was taken a victim of a scam where they actually came to her house, took her to a Bitcoin ATM, something about a false deposit. With $4,000 in her account that they made it look like it was a real deposit, but it wasn't, and she paid them back. And ultimately, I think it ended up with her being out of $300,000. How uncommon is something like that, Alex?
So I think the stories that we hear where someone's actually coming to your house as a result of a online scam are pretty rare. You know, I think when we kind of dig into those, you oftentimes find it was someone they knew, or someone local that knew they had a lot of Bitcoin or cryptocurrency or something like that. It's much more common for scams to kind of just happen over the internet with people that may be halfway around the world. You know, because when you start getting into going to someone's house and making them go to an ATM and so on and so forth, you're in a whole different set of consequences if you're caught. So we really don't see those as often. I can't remember the story, but about a year ago, there was someone that wrote a pretty well circulated article in a major publication. I forget which one, about something similar where they were tricked and scammed and the people actually came to their house and delivered a bad check and things like that. But that's pretty rare to hear about.
Primarily, it's online, right?
Correct. I mean, if you think about it, right? I mean, it's just, you know, we can all see the numbers and how many people are actually caught and have consequences for doing these scams. It's pretty close to zero. And so it's just, you know, if you can do it that way, why would you, you know, start getting into kidnapping and, you know, the risk of getting caught in person?
So one thing I have seen a lot more of on my phone, and I don't often, I never really respond to them other than yesterday because I was just watching Three Body Problem and it irritated me. So it's like, all right, you want to play? Let's play, which I shouldn't have done. But what's the next generation of it seems like the wrong inadvertent messages have exploded. What's the next step? Do you know?
So really, you mean the next step once they kind of hook you with the incorrect message?
Well, no, the next scam once people catch on to.
The next
too.
Big thing?
Yeah.
You know, if you had asked me a few months ago, I probably would have said that AI was not going to take off with scamming as much as people were worried about. But mm-hmm. now I think we're starting to see a lot more of that, right? So people are using AI to write better phishing emails. Mm. And then we're also seeing, you know, some of these or an increase in these calls where somebody will clone your voice. Mm. And even make a video, a cloned video of you where they can interact with video to scam you. So those are starting to uptick. And I think in the next year or two, we're going to continue to see where, you know, voice and video are not something that we can trust anymore.
Thank you. I appreciate your time as always. Alex Hammerstone, Director of Advisory Solutions for Trusted Sec. Chase sent out a message saying that, you know, if there's a system glitch that shows there's more money in your account than you have and you withdraw it, it's fraud. It's stealing. You can't do it. The latest, I guess, because it seems as though, in what I read, it seems as though that they've now put together an all-star team with Ransom Hub ransomware. What is that?
I think the story here is that, you know, as we get better at preventing these things, or as law enforcement kind of moves in, people don't suddenly kind of move on and you know, kind of go work for some corporation, mm-hmm. right? The people that are doing these ransomware attacks are going to continue to do them. They're incredibly well organized and professional, and a lot of these different groups work together. And if you think about it, it's, you know, similar to the way that a lot of people might move around organizations for different or better opportunities, you know, to make more money or what have you. A lot of people kind of in the ransomware realm are going to be doing the same thing. And, you know, over the years, we've just seen kind of constant notifications from, you know, the government and law enforcement about how different groups are working together and, you know, how they're changing and joining other groups and so on and so forth.
So what's the latest iteration of this and how much of a threat is it?
So I think if we look at just what's in the news, right, I mean, it's pretty obvious, I think, to all of us that the ransomware attacks, the cyber attacks are continuing to grow, right? They're not slowing down. And the bigger thing is when you think about it, you know, most of these ransomware attacks are never going to be big news stories. They become large news stories when it's a municipality or an airport or something unique, right? Something that affects a lot of consumers. But day in and day out, most of these ransomware attacks are barely going to be a blip on kind of local news channels, right? Organizations lose hundreds of thousands of dollars or even millions of dollars all the time, right? And so often that it's just not a news story. And it's just continued to grow. It's not slowing down. And I think one of the pieces, you know, from this alert that came out is that it really is all organizations that are being hit by this. You know, there's really, it's kind of gloves off, you know, they're kind of going after everybody.
What is it that we can do to protect ourselves, and or is it us that have to worry, or is it businesses primarily when it comes to ransomware attacks?
So in these cases, I mean, there are certainly ransomware attacks that affect end users, right? So you might open up your computer one day and it's, you know, your personal computer, and it's, you know, encrypted and you can't get in. But generally, if you think about the reward and kind of the risk that the ransomware operators take, they're looking for these large payouts. You know, and there might be some people out there with a very high net worth that are listening, that maybe would be willing to pay to get their files back on their personal computer. But generally, these groups are going after organizations that either have cyber insurance or have, you know, the funds to be able to pay a ransom. You know, generally, it's, if you think about it, you know, if you've got a bunch of kids and such and have, you know, a few hundred bucks in your checking account, you're probably not a target. They really are going after organizations.
All right, let me take a break. We'll pick it up. We come back. I also want to talk about something I heard on a program that we run this morning with Gordon Deal. First News, I think, is America's First News, about a lady that was scammed. They even came to her house, took her to a Bitcoin ATM, and then there was some kind of ruse where they made it seem as though $4,000 had been actually accidentally deposited into her account, which she paid back, but there was no false deposit, which means she was out of the $4,000. We'll talk about some things like that when we return as well. Alex Hammerstone, our friend, Director of Advisory Solutions for TrustedSec. If you have any questions about internet security, tech scams, etc., he is our guy, 504-260-1870. This text comes in and says, computer tech stuff really makes me feel dumb, and I'm the smartest person I know. Well, join the club. It's constantly changing and evolving. That's why we're lucky to have Alex to talk to. 851 Traffic, WWL. 8:56, 4 till 9. Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Alex Hammerstone, our friend, Director of Advisory Solutions for TrustedSec. So I heard on the show we run at 5 o'clock, Gordon Deal, America's First News, that a lady was taken a victim of a scam where they actually came to her house, took her to a Bitcoin ATM, something about a false deposit. With $4,000 in her account that they made it look like it was a real deposit, but it wasn't, and she paid them back. And ultimately, I think it ended up with her being out of $300,000. How uncommon is something like that, Alex?
So I think the stories that we hear where someone's actually coming to your house as a result of a online scam are pretty rare. You know, I think when we kind of dig into those, you oftentimes find it was someone they knew, or someone local that knew they had a lot of Bitcoin or cryptocurrency or something like that. It's much more common for scams to kind of just happen over the internet with people that may be halfway around the world. You know, because when you start getting into going to someone's house and making them go to an ATM and so on and so forth, you're in a whole different set of consequences if you're caught. So we really don't see those as often. I can't remember the story, but about a year ago, there was someone that wrote a pretty well-circulated article in a major publication, I forget which one, about something similar where they were tricked and scammed and the people actually came to their house and delivered a bad check and things like that. But that's pretty rare to hear about.
Primarily, it's online, right?
Correct. I mean, if you think about it, right? I mean, it's just, you know, we can all see the numbers and how many people are actually caught and have consequences for doing these scams. It's pretty close to zero. And so it's just, you know, if you can do it that way, why would you, you know, start getting into kidnapping and, you know, the risk of getting caught in person?
So one thing I have seen a lot more of on my phone, and I don't often, I never really respond to them other than yesterday because I was just watching Three Body Problem and it irritated me. So it's like, all right, you want to play Let's Play, which I shouldn't have done. But what's the next generation of it seems like the wrong inadvertent messages have exploded. What's the next step? Do you know?
So really, you mean the next step once they kind of hook you with the incorrect message?
Well, no, the next scam once people catch on
to. Oh, the next big thing?
Yeah.
You know, if you had asked me a few months ago, I probably would have said that AI was not going to take off with scamming as much as people were worried about. But mm-hmm. Now I think we're starting to see a lot more of that, right? So people are using AI to write better phishing emails. Mm-hmm. And then we're also seeing, you know, some of these or an increase in these calls where somebody will clone your voice. Mm-hmm. And even make a cloned video of you where they can interact with video to scam you. So those are starting to uptick. And I think in the next year or two, we're going to continue to see where, voice and video are not something that we can trust anymore.
Thank you. I appreciate your time as always. Alex Hammerstone, Director of Advisory Solutions for Trusted Sec. Chase sent out a message saying that, if there's a system glitch that shows there's more money in your account than you have and you withdraw it, it's fraud. It's stealing. You can't do it.
Presented by T-Mobile, the official wireless partner of Odyssey Sports. With an awesome network and great savings, there's never been a better time to join T-Mobile. Visit your neighborhood store to make the switch today.
This is Jean Marie Laskus with the podcast Cement City. So there's this election coming up, a big one, and one guy's been indicted. People are talking voter fraud. Democracy itself is on the line. Sound familiar? Well, this isn't that election. This one is in Denora, Pennsylvania, a dying town in the middle of nowhere, where I bought a house and stayed for 3 years. Listen to and follow Cement City, an Odyssey original podcast in partnership with Cement City Productions, available now for free on the Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.